I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Metnick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. Napoleon Bonaparte is considered one of the greatest military leaders of all time. He is often mentioned alongside names such as Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, but whereas they existed thousands of years ago, he died only 200 years ago. And as such, his legacy is perhaps still being shaped more so than other comparatively more ancient figures. So what is the legacy of Napoleon? What are some of the preconceptions that have permeated into modern thought? Beyond his military achievement, what made Napoleon so great? Or is that the wrong question? Was Napoleon great? After all, some point to him as an early prototype for 20th century dictators such as Mussolini, Hitler, and Stalin. But is that fair or a mere oversimplification of history? I was joined on this episode by a world-famous English historian and journalist, Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the author of The Storm of War, A New History of the Second World War, and he wrote the widely acclaimed biography of Winston Churchill. In 2014, he published one of the most detailed and extensive biographies of Napoleon to date, entitled Napoleon the Great, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Best Biography. But before sharing my chat with Andrew, I thought it would be helpful to give a very brief overview and simplified overview of the life of Napoleon and the history of France in the period when he was in power to give you a little bit more context of the conversation we had. Napoleon was born in 1769 in Corsica, previously a part of the Genoese Republic of Italy, which had recently been incorporated into France. So for much of his life, he was actually considered a bit of a French outsider, and he and his family had their own significant gripes with France proper. His father, however, applied to be part of the Corsican nobility, and with this came Napoleon's opportunity to study at the Royal Military School of Brienne-le-Château, where he got a military education. The French Revolution began in 1789 and took place when Napoleon was in his teenage years and in his 20s. During the French Revolution, the French monarchy was overthrown, and King Louis XVI and many other members of the royal family and monarchist supporters were killed by the guillotine. Due to his younger age, Napoleon didn't really play an active part in the French Revolution, though his anti-monarchist political ideologies were naturally shaped by the years of revolution and subsequent turnover in French leadership. In the 1790s, Napoleon began to develop his reputation as a French military hero. His first major military accomplishments came in Italy, where he conquered large parts of Italy and subsequently instituted political and legal reforms in those areas that he had captured. This was followed by a military campaign in Egypt, which was less successful than his time in Italy, with many of his men dying from malaria. Also during this campaign, he committed what would be considered today as wartime crimes in the city of Jaffa, where many men from opposing forces were brutally killed. In 1799, Napoleon officially came to power in France when he staged a coup on November 11th. The government he was replacing was a largely corrupt one, and since the French Revolution, nobody had really maintained a firm grip on any meaningful power. Following the coup, Napoleon became first consul of France. As leader of France, some of the policies he championed revolved around a separation of church and state, standardizing education, centralizing government, and expanding human rights reforms. As leader of France, Napoleon attempted to broker many peace treaties in Europe. These peace initiatives made Napoleon popular in France, and he was eventually declared France's first consul for life. He was also named emperor by Pope Pius VII. Nonetheless, the peace he brokered with Britain was ineffective, and Britain declared war on France shortly after, aligning with other European powers against France. Britain's unwillingness to maintain a peace with France ended up spurring many of Napoleon's future conflicts and wars throughout his time in power, not just with Britain, but with other countries aligned with Britain who refused to adhere to some of Napoleon's economic policies. In 1812, provoked by Europe's refusal to fully embrace his economic policies and other political agendas, he entered into a costly war with Russia, where his troops advanced.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
All the way to Moscow. His troops incurred losses of over 500,000 men, and the campaign was widely considered a catastrophic disaster. In 1813, he had an impressive sequence of 13 battle victories, but ultimately, after being so weakened the year before from the war in Russia, Paris was eventually invaded and Napoleon was captured. He was sent to exile on the island of Elba after almost 15 years in power. Napoleon, though, then escaped from Elba shortly afterwards in 1814 and managed to briefly reestablish his power as leader of France. But a few months later, he once again lost his grip on the country, losing at the Battle of Waterloo. He was exiled to the British island of Sainte-Hélène, where he resided from 1814 until his death from stomach cancer in 1821. So that is an extremely simplified and abbreviated biography of the life of Napoleon Bonaparte, but I'm hoping that by sharing that basic timeline and chronology of some of the main events, the following conversation will hold greater meaning to you.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So without further ado, this was my conversation with Andrew Roberts. So Andrew, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me on, Zale. It is an honor to be here.
It's an absolute honor to have you. You're quite the famous historian, and you've written some amazingly complex and detailed works. So it's really a treat to be able to chat with you.
I've also written a few lightweight and short ones. I keep being told by people that my books are always 1,000 pages long. They're not. There are plenty that are an awful lot shorter than that. I want to make that point right at the beginning.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good to know. They are long, but they're long because they're complex lives that you're exploring and doing such in-depth research. For this Napoleon book, for example, you went through how many letters of Napoleon?
38,000. Yeah, he wrote 38,000 letters from his first ones as he was an infant, virtually, right the way through to the last one, which was only a couple of days before he died. And he was a huge letter writer. And some of them would be very, very short, you know, just moving a few troops from one place to another, hundreds of miles away. And others would be fairly complex. Almost all of them were dictated from his adult years, were dictated. He had four secretaries who worked round the clock, 24 hours a day. So he knew that even if he woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, there would be a secretary ready to take dictation. He would dictate to them in the bath sometimes and in coaches and during meal times, you know. So all in all, he was somebody who just believed that he was working. He was a total workaholic anyhow, but he was working 24 hours a day.
How did you go about looking through that many letters? How long did that take?
The book took 6 years to write. And the way I work, I mean, lots of historians do it in different ways, but the way I find works for me is to get all of the information together first before you write a single word. So the actual writing of the book only takes, out of a book like that, I think it was like 5 or 6 months, but for the research, it's well over 5 years.
So let's get into Napoleon then. Prior to your research and writing this, what connected you to him? You obviously, as we've said, put enormous time and effort into every political figure you choose to write about or historical figure. What attracted you to write it?
Well, the personality, the giant. I'm an Englishman, and so, of course, he tried to invade this country, so he has a fascination in that sense. He is the personification of leadership in many ways, and so in that sense also. I thought that there were an awful lot of good books about specific aspects of his policy or his military genius or his personality, but there wasn't really a single overarching biography that stood out for me back in 2008 when I started to think about writing and researching this book. So actually, you know, there are thousands upon thousands of Napoleon books, I did, I think, spot a bit of a gap in the market for a single comprehensive Cradle to the Grave life.
And what a way to get that comprehensive view by looking at his letters. So it's a really unique viewpoint in the books, because it's really his viewpoint that you're dissecting for so many pages of it.
Well, it's his voice all the time, you know. I mean, I think people, that's what they're after when they're reading a biography. Yes, they want to know what the chap did or the woman did. Yes, they wanted to know, you know, the great events and so on. But what they really want to do is to try to get under the skin of the person, to work out what made them tick, to see what they were like, almost to try to sort of meet them over the intervening centuries. And so for that, you really do need to have the authentic voice, and nothing is better, apart from perhaps a diary. Diaries can do it as well. But other than that, it needs the immediacy of correspondence.
What's it like to write about somebody who lived, I say just, but relatively just 200 years ago? Because he didn't necessarily live so long ago, maybe, that his image in history has already been completely mythologized. But on the same token, he lived a lot longer ago than the historical figures of the 20th century. So he's not as remote as people like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar. So we're closer to the source material, but we're getting far away from his life. Do you feel an extra sort of, I don't want to say pressure, but an extra weight of responsibility or sense of urgency as we get further away from his life?
Yes, very much. That's a good question. I mean, the thing about somebody who died, well, in this case, 200 years ago, back in May of this year, is that, of course, there's nobody who ever met him, so you can't interview anybody. And there's nobody who ever met anybody who ever met him. So it really is sort of too far away to conduct anything personal like that. And yet, as you say, it's not Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar, where he's a sort of established figure set in stone and, you know, immobile in that sense. You know, the other points about Napoleon is, of course, he's looked at very differently depending on which country you come from. A Frenchman will have a totally different view as an Englishman, as a Russian, as an American. And that will be, that's an interesting aspect of Napoleon. What I was very much trying to do with this book was not just to write it from the English perspective, but very much from a properly internationalist perspective, where the reader, you know, wouldn't necessarily know that that I was British or French or Russian or...
And that certainly comes across in the book. As you're aware, the title of the podcast is Preconceived, and with Napoleon, I think there are so many preconceptions associated with him. And I guess we'll start with his military accomplishments, because I think to the general public who might not know so much about his life, I think the perception might be first and foremost that he's remembered as a military conqueror. So what was so remarkable about, and maybe conqueror is the wrong word there, because he wasn't just set, one myth is maybe that he was just going out and conquering things, but a lot of the wars he were engaged in were actually defensive wars. But what was so remarkable about his military achievements that makes him stand out amongst the names of history?
I think the fact that he was able to win battles, he fought 60 battles, won 47 of them, drew 7, lost 7. So if you were a football team, you know, it'd be an extraordinarily good record. But I think what makes him so remarkable is that he was able to win battles, whether he was whether he had more men than the enemy or fewer, more cavalry or artillery or fewer, whether he was retreating or advancing, whether he was concentrating on the right flank or the left flank, whether he was relieving a garrison, a city, or whether he was breaking out of one. The sheer dexterity and the multiplicity of the situations that he managed to find victory in are truly extraordinary. You know, and I deliberately wanted to go into every battle. Some people have criticized this book because it is very much military history, you know, but he was primarily a general, although his achievements, of course, went far beyond the battlefield, and in fact outlasted the battles by a very long way, in a very long time. Nonetheless, basically, you do have a soldier here, and I wanted to explain why he was so good on 47 of those 60 battlefields.
In addition to that, I guess, military record, we'll call it, which is really impressive, was it also the scope and the breadth of lands that he fought in that...
Yes, actually, that's a very good point. I mean, I shouldn't have just talked about towns and things, but countries as well. You know, he started in Italy, but where lots of fighting had taken place historically between the French and the Austrians. But he then went to Egypt, captured Cairo, went through Syria, through modern-day Israel. He fought again in Italy. He had to fight the Austrians and captured Vienna. When he fought the Prussians, he captured Berlin. He fought extensively in Spain. He fought right the way over into Russia, of course, disastrously. But he didn't start off disastrously. And he fought around Paris. You know, there were country after country, be it Vienna or Berlin or Madrid or indeed Moscow, you know, the capital city fell to Napoleon. And in country after country, in fact, visiting his battlefields took me, I think, to something like 16 countries all over Poland and Hungary. He fought in, you name it, his greatest victory, Austerlitz, was in Bohemia in the Czech Republic. So, yes, he was incredibly peripatetic as well as talented.
And was that magnitude of his military achievements, was that at the time something that was, and you weren't there, obviously, none of us were, but was that something that was obvious at the time to people or obvious now that, wow, this stands out as one of the great military leaders of all time, just in terms of the sheer scope? Is that quite unusual to have been so dispersed in so many countries?
Yeah, by sort of 1810, 1811, yes, it was very unusual. I mean, Wellington had fought in India, and he'd fought in the Maratha Wars and had covered a lot of of ground in India with the siege of Seringapatam and so on. So that took British soldiers a long way in terms of sheer distance because, of course, of the sheer size of India. But in terms of numbers of countries that one marches through, you do have to go back to Alexander or Caesar or one of the great early, Hannibal, perhaps one of the great early conquerors of history, to see quite that sort of magnitude of invasion and conquering. Yeah. Which, by the way, was the key to his undoing. Of course, because, you know, once you've invaded, you know, X number of countries, you've got X number of enemies who want ultimately to bring you down. So it's not, I'm in no way sort of condoning this march of invasion and conquest.
Well, that also brings up another point, because while he has such major military accomplishments, one thing that becomes clear in the book is while he did have huge military accomplishments, you also consider the amount of men he lost. And in several of his campaigns, and like you said, Russia, which was one of his last major advances before his decline, the conditions were so terrible that men in his army were killing themselves. So when we say he was such an amazing military man, do we need to take that in context about how many people he lost?
Yes, very much, very much. And yes, in that Russian campaign, they weren't just committing suicide, but they were actually committing cannibalism. I mean, it was very, very, you know, elemental, basic, part of the human condition, really, that you see things in that campaign that straight out of a Hieronymus Bosch painting. No. But yes, he did lose a lot of men. But one point I do try to argue in my book is that he wasn't just some kind of a maniac who invaded countries for the sheer hell of it. And of the seven wars of the coalition, as they're called, he started two of them, and the other five were started by his enemies against him, either invading France or attacking France's allies and so on. So I don't think that, although you can definitely blame the 1812 campaign and also the Peninsular campaign, the invasion of Spain and Portugal in 1808 and 1809 on Napoleon, all of the other wars were actually wars of defense.
And that's definitely something that I think is a preconception that I certainly hadn't realized. One of the ways Napoleon has been mythologized to a sense is that maybe he was this power-hungry person who was just looking to be a dictator and gain power. But like you said there, that's really not quite true on some levels, because he did launch a couple of offensives, but mostly they were defensives. And the couple offensives that he did launch, they weren't just because he wanted more land, it seems. There were actual reasons that prompted him to fight.
Well, neither of those attacks, the one on the Iberian Peninsula or the one on Russia, were about land and territory. Earlier ones were. Earlier ones wanted to get the land up to the Rhine River that would protect the borders of France. But that was really a French revolutionary. I mean, that was a desire, a strategic desire of the French long before Napoleon came to power. But the two wars that went so disastrously badly for him were actually driven by economic beliefs, by the Colbertian system, whereby countries were in economic blocks and they could only trade with one another. This was a way of obviously trying to force the British to the negotiating table if they could have no trade with the Iberian Peninsula or indeed with Russia. Napoleon assumed that they would have to one day come to the negotiating table. But what he didn't factor in was the sort of free market aspect of it, which was that there would be a tremendous amount of smuggling that would go on across the entire European coastline, pretty much to buy British goods and for Britain to sell them. And also that, you know, there were other places in the world that Britain could trade. Our trade with South America, with Asia, to a lesser extent with the United States, apart from obviously during the War of 1812, was driven by a desire to find other markets beyond Europe. So had Napoleon sort of embrace the principles of Adam Smith, who'd only written Wealth of Nations in the 1770s. he might not have been drawn into the two most disastrous campaigns of his career, where he lost a quarter of a million men in Spain and Portugal, and half a million men in over half a million men in Russia.
You touched on there about economic philosophies, and a big part of Napoleon beyond his military achievements that is lesser known, but perhaps more important in the grand scheme of history, is Napoleon the reformer, the politician, the philosopher, and some of the ideas that he was trying to spread across France and in Europe and maybe even the world. What were some of those main philosophical tenets and political reforms that encompassed what's known as the Napoleonic Code, ideals that he was trying to spread that were really the impetus that led to a lot of his wars, because he saw this as the greater good for a new direction of Europe?
Well, he didn't come up with them himself. I think it's very important to remember that the Napoleonic Code was in embryo before he came to power. But what he did was to sort of cut the Gordian knot of French politics to allow them to actually get onto the statute book and become law. Because up until then, from the moment of the French Revolution, for the next 10 years onwards, people kept arguing about them, but actually very little was in fact done. And it only became law once he had established his dictatorship. And I think the word dictatorship is very important. You mentioned it a little earlier in this podcast, but it's very important to state that the concept of dictatorship in France and Napoleonic dictatorship in the 19th century was wholly removed from the kind of murderous anti-Semitic dictatorships that emerged in the 20th century. No, he was not a totalitarian dictator. He had no large-scale police. He had no anti-Semitic beliefs. He had none of the desire to rule the minds of all of his subjects that you see in the later 20th century dictatorship. So you know, let's remember that when we consider this concept of the positive aspects of Napoleon and what he really wanted to use his dictatorship for.
And I think that's a really important point to actually discuss before we talk about the Napoleonic Code and get into some of those policy things, because you're right. You've commented before, I read Napoleon was a dictator politically and that he dictated the laws of France and what happened, but I don't think he has anything in common with the 20th century dictators. And a lot of people who don't know much about Napoleon might look at him as a prototype for Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, but you really, really, and it's important for his legacy, make it clear that that's not the kind of person he was. So what were his primary motivations then? Because he did, on the same hand, look to people. He was studying Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar from a young age and looked to them as icons.
Well, I think in both of those cases, but primarily in Julius Caesar's case, he admired Caesar as well as being a soldier and a general and a leader, because he was also a great reformer. And what he wanted to do was essentially to establish the principles of the French Revolution, keep the best of them, and get rid of all the dross. And my God, there was a lot of dross when it came to the philosophy and the principles of the French Revolution. They believed in this cult of the supreme being. They believed in a 10-day week. They used the guillotine to kill some 40,000 Frenchmen during the revolution. You know, he wanted to get rid of all of that sort of mad stuff. And he wanted to concentrate on the really positive aspects, things like equality before the law, like freedom to worship, like the concept of meritocracy. These really sort of uplifting modern principles that we live by today, but which were considered revolutionary back in France in the late 18th and early 19th century. And so what you see with Napoleon is this sort of reforming sweep that doesn't stop at the borders of France, but actually goes on. I mean, the Napoleonic Code formed the basis of government in the Rhineland, in Germany, until the year 1900. So, you know, there is, and it can be found in the legal codes of many countries, even today, including your state of Louisiana in America, has got aspects that were borrowed from the Napoleonic Code. Now, this doesn't mean that it was great for all people, you know, all the time. it was immensely and intensely sexist. It put the paterfamilias, the male of the family, in an immensely powerful position. His job was to protect his wife, but certainly not to allow any power to his wife, or indeed wealth. And so, understandably, in modern France today, there are an awful lot of people, especially on the feminist side of the political movement, who decry the Napoleonic Code as having been a, if anything, a sort of step back from the previous regime. I think it's fair to say the Napoleonic Code was an advance, but certainly not in the field of sexual relations. But then even there, you have to remember that the French have historically been very badly behind whichever regime it is. They didn't actually give women the vote until 1945.
Wow, that's a long time. That's over 100.
And that can't be blamed on Napoleon, you know, who died in 1821.
So the Napoleonic Code and a lot of the things he was promoting, despite perhaps being, as some people have described him, misogynistic or not out for women's rights, he really did advance, you're saying, human rights. He tried to have a meritocracy, meaning reducing royal privilege, because again, this is after the French Revolution, when there is still monarchist influences. So he tried to take a step towards a meritocracy.
And well, not just royal influence, but of course the nobles, the influence of the nobles, who had taken a terrible basting, of course, at the time of the French Revolution, and you know, thousands of them being guillotined. But actually there was a serious sort of danger that the whole system was going to come back. In a sense, it did come back, because Napoleon did reimpose nobility in France, the concept of nobility with princes and dukes and counts and so on, but barons. But he brought it back for people who had shown merit. And this was the key thing. You know, his 26 marshals of France, half of them came from the working classes, which was never been seen in history before. Nothing like that. No marshal of France had ever come up from the ranks. But under Napoleon, you have people like Ney and Bernadotte and Oudinot and others who were the children of barrel coopers and innkeepers and domestic servants and peasants and so on. And this was the first time in 1,000 years that this had happened, because before in French history, your social status, your rank in the world, was entirely decided by your fathers and grandfathers.
And that's a big change, not just in France, but that permeates to the rest of Europe in many ways, correct?
Which is one of the reasons, of course, that the other legitimacy nations like Austria and Prussia and Russia, and to an extent Britain, wanted to stop him and bring him down, because they didn't want that in their country. The aristocracies of those countries saw in Napoleon a sweeping fire of meritocracy and sort of essentially something that threatened their very raison d'être.
And that's what surprised me when reading the book. I never considered Napoleon this progressive reformer until I actually learned about him. But it sounds like, while not on every stance, clearly, as you said about women, and he also had at some points promoted slavery, at sometimes abolished slavery, so a complicated relationship to slavery there. But on many levels, he was really quite a reformer. He also introduced more of a centralized government and economic policies, education reform. He was influenced by the Enlightenment and had a reverence for scientific advancements and promotion for the arts. This is a really novel figure, not this classic dictator that people associate.
Precisely. But he wouldn't have been able to have done all this unless he was able to dictate the laws of France. He did it as a result of consultation with his Conseil d'État, which he set up, which still exists today, actually, like many, many of his inventions, especially, as you mentioned, in the educational and organizational and administrative sphere, and indeed the financial sphere. He set up the Banque de France. But yeah, you see these things lasting for two centuries, and they wouldn't have done that. They don't do that just out of reverence for Napoleon. They brought down Napoleon's nephew in 1870. So it wasn't out of any sense of reverence. It was the fact that these things worked. These institutions worked, and the lycée and the Sorbonne and so on, you know, actually produced verifiably positive results. I think it's very important to go back to something you mentioned earlier, which of course resonates incredibly powerfully to American audiences, which is this concept of slavery. Because, as you say, it was abolished by the French Revolution. It caused a revolution in Haiti, which was one of the French, important French sugar-producing islands out in the West Indies. And Napoleon in 1802, when the Peace of Amiens was signed with the British, reimposed it. And this, of course, is you know, about the most original sin that you can come up with, especially in the American sense, to actually reimpose a system like that. But I think it's important to remember that something like a third of the French economy was based on the West Indies. And the way in which they had tried to organize the rest of the economy in a way that was going to be able to survive the end of slavery in the West Indies, and it frankly hadn't worked. And so entirely deplorably, Napoleon did reimpose slavery. As soon as he had the opportunity to later on, he abolished it again. And because the French weren't in control of the Atlantic pretty much at all between the reintroduction of the war in 1803 and the fall of Napoleon in 1815, the reintroduction of slavery, that was pretty much the last chance that they had to do that. And so this will be a major blot. And I think that was established by President Macron. I mean, he went and gave the speech at Les Invalides on the bicentenary of Napoleon's death. But, you know, he quite rightly had to discuss this issue of the reintroduction of slavery, which is, as I say, a serious blot on his discussion. But, you know, he had to take a pretty hard-nosed realpolitik look at what the French economy could or could not bear.
Yeah. Before we move on to Napoleon's personality, which I think is really interesting and helps us understand the man and why he was so successful, I want to go back to his motivations and the way that he did get power, because he stages a coup in 1799, and then he becomes emperor and is declared the first consul for life a few years later after that. What does that say about him and his legacy? Was this title more so bestowed upon him, or was this something he aggressively sought to become emperor and first consul for life? Or are we just unfairly looking at that whole concept through the modern lens of democracy?
Well, he was hugely ambitious, of course. He wanted supreme power. He recognized that at a really very young age, you know, he was 30 when the Brumaire coup that you're referring to was undertaken. But he had, I think there's nothing wrong with ambition if you've got the talent to justify it. And he undoubtedly did, for the reasons that we've already mentioned, his administrative genius and so on. So actually, yes, he overthrew the government, but it was a hardly a sort of, you know, democratic elected government in the first place. It was a revolutionary government. It was a government of what was called the Directory of five people. And he replaced it with a consulate of three people, which he was undoubtedly the first consul. When this revolution had been established as the result of a referendum, once the referendum had taken place and it had given him an overwhelming majority, which, by the way, his brother fiddled the figures somewhat, but nonetheless, it's still, even if he hadn't fiddled the figures, he would still have won that referendum. He then went one stage further, which was to establish his position for life. And this was still within the republican concept. It wasn't until he declared himself emperor that he really did set aside any pretense at republicanism and instead made it clear that this was going to be an empire that was going to carry on in his family beyond himself. And he had no children at the time, at least no legitimate children, that he established the empire. And so it was going to be his eldest brother, Joseph, who was going to take over after he died. But later on, of course, once he did have a son, it became quite clear to Republicans that if they wanted a Republic of France, they not only had to get rid of Napoleon, but also all his family too.
Are the comparisons to some of those dictators from the 20th century that we mentioned, are they maybe prevalent because he was the emperor and did declare himself the emperor for life? So that's what draws people to make such similarities?
Not really, actually. I don't think so, because neither Hitler nor Stalin nor Mao nor pretty much any of the 20th century dictators, and except, of course, for the North Korean ones, try to put their children on the throne after them. They very much see their regimes as being taken over by the revolutionary cadre, the next person along in the sort of cursus honorum of the revolutionary cadre. But for Napoleon, it was very much a sort of throwback to the empires of Caesar and Alexander, who you know, believed in the hereditary principle.
And I guess what really distinguishes Napoleon from a lot of those negative figures of the 20th century is, and it's not black and white here, but did he commit those unforgivable atrocities compared to these other figures that we're talking about? And there's a couple...
He did on a couple of occasions, yes. Padua in 1796, he put down a revolt of the Italian Catholic peasantry with untoward aggression and violence. And then more famously, Jaffa in 1799, he executed some 3,000 or so. The numbers actually are very disputed historically, but I would put them at around 3,000 Turkish artillerymen who had given their parole, i.e. they promised not to raise their arms up against the French Republic when they were captured in the Gaza area 6 weeks earlier. And then when they were recaptured, having fought against the French Republic at the time of the siege of Jaffa, he had them executed. And that is clearly a war crime by any sort of modern sense. But in the Middle Eastern sense, in the 18th century sense, once you break your parole, you do forfeit your life. So it's you know, utterly ruthless and abominable thing to have done in the modern sense. But I think, again, you have to really put it in its geographical and historical context. And if you do that, then he's not committing, you know, the Holocaust or the mass starvation of Ukrainian kulaks, or let alone the murder of 60 million people in China by Mao. You know, I think these are sort of entirely different sets of atrocities. And also, you do occasionally get it being committed on the Allied side. The Admiral Nelson, for example, executed 99. Neapolitan Jacobins, revolutionaries who had been captured. They surrendered themselves to him on the basis that they were going to get a fair trial. And then he handed them over to the Neapolitan Bourbons, who hanged them all. And so, you know, that's a pretty bad war crime too. It's not just Napoleon who commits them.
So in regards to his personality, what are some of the most pivotal attributes and his personality traits that you attribute to what makes him such a success and a successful and unique military and political leader? The first thing that comes to mind from reading it was it seems like he had this incredible ability to compartmentalize. He refers to this idea, this ability is, it's a pulling out a drawer in his mind, I think was written in your book. He didn't let the disasters in one part of his empire or his personal life infringe on his ability to deal wholeheartedly with other domains of his empire. And that amazing capacity to compartmentalize emotions, allowing him to be more effective when one thing wasn't going well.
Yes, you see this again and again. A few days after let's start with the Battle of Borodino in 1812, where just as this battle is starting, which is at the time was the bloodiest battle in the history of mankind, he wrote a letter setting out the rules and regulations of a girls' school that he wanted to set up in Saint-Denis, just outside Paris. I mean, when you think of the things that must have been on his mind with regard to this, the unfolding of this battle, and yet he could entirely compartmentalize. As you say, he said, my mind is like a chest of drawers. I can open a drawer And then when I close it, it's completely closed. I can open another one. And regardless of what's going on, a few weeks after the Battle of Borodino, he's in Moscow and the Kremlin burns down. Indeed, the whole of central Moscow burns down. And you know, he's taken away to a safer part of the city. And that night, literally as sort of ashes and the flames all around him, he writes the rules of the Comédie Française, which are still in existence today. He was during the amazing march from the English Channel to Austerlitz. On that march, where he's coordinating a vast army, you know, 500,000 men or so, to fall upon the Austrians and the Russians in the Czech, what's now the Czech Republic. And he also is able, as the carriage is moving along, to order the prefect of Genoa to stop taking his mistress to the opera. And this is a really extraordinary capacity that he has to do that. So that, yes, that's one thing. Another would be his sense of humour, which comes as a bit of a surprise, I think, to a lot of people who read my book, or at least when they write to me. It's lovely having feedback from readers. And one of the things that they mention quite a lot of the times is that they didn't expect Napoleon to be so funny. There are about 80 Napoleon jokes in my book, where he's constantly, you know, making. You can see why his entourage was so devoted to him, because he made them laugh so much. And he'd make jokes, you know, even at very sort of bad and dangerous times, he'd be cracking jokes, you know, one after the other. And so that was a very attractive feature of Napoleon that I wasn't really expecting, actually, when I started to write this book.
And his connection to his soldiers, you talk about, was really strong. And it sounds like he had a soldier's mentality. He knew a lot of the soldiers. There's one incredible story where he remembered somebody's name and some details of their life 10 years after having met them once, just a common soldier. Was that also very important in him having the support of his troops and the confidence of his army to really want to fight for him?
No, undoubtedly, yes. I mean, you have to remember, of course, he thought like a soldier because he was one. He was really from the age of 8 when he went to his first military academy. He was always going to be an officer in the army. He became an officer very young. He was a general at the age of 24. You know, so soldiering was absolutely instinctive to him and part of his whole Weltanschauung, you know. And so you can see, therefore, that you know, being an officer, being a leader, especially at the time of the revolution, where you couldn't just depend on the fact that your family had been aristocrats. In fact, you absolutely must not depend on that, because they were guillotining aristocrats and army officers all the time. And so you instead had to show a much more modern sense of leadership, a much more interactive one, where you, yes, you could give orders, of course you could, but you also needed to be loved and to be popular. And so there are just any number of ways that Napoleon did that. One you've just mentioned, a fantastic capacity for remembering people and for rewarding. He was very good at rewarding bravery on the battlefield. He'd sometimes actually, if he saw somebody do something brave or heard somebody had done something brave, he would take off his own Légion d'honneur, the order of chivalry that he had himself invented, and pin it onto the soldier's breast there and then. Wow. which would give you a pension. And make sure your, you know, family were well off. Well, that kind of thing was tremendously popular, as you can imagine, in the army. He would make sure that his sentries always got wine before anybody else. He'd allow the drummer boys to come and sit around the campfire on, you know, if it was cold. There he would go and visit campfires at night and talk to and josh with the troops, you know. And the numbers of ways that he showed leadership are extraordinary. And he would also, of course, use shame and anger as well. If he thought that a regiment or a demi-regiment had not done well in a battle, or if they'd run away, he would threaten them and he would say, I'm going to take away your standard, I'm going to break up this regiment, you know, it's never going to be heard of again unless in the next battle you show me that you deserve to stay together as a fighting unit. And always that would work as well. You know, I mean, it's a tough stance to take, and sometimes that kind of thing could go wrong, but it didn't. And so, yes, I really very much wanted in this book to set out the sort of secrets of leadership that Napoleon used.
It sounds like he was a fun guy to be around, who was personable, and also he's very philosophical and deep. He was a really avid reader and writer and read a lot of philosophy. So he's extremely intelligent beyond just military endeavors, obviously, as we spoke about before, and that obviously influenced the Napoleonic code that, like you said, he didn't create, but he embodied in many senses in his views.
Yeah, he wrote short stories and a couple of novellas. One of them, Eugénie and Clisson, I noticed earlier today as I was walking past my local bookshop, is actually for sale as a paperback book, which is quite a thing. You know, you can't really imagine any of the 20th century dictators writing basically it's a love story that would still be on sale 200 years after he...
It's got to be selling if it's on sale, you know?
yeah, well, exactly. And he wrote some actually searing sort of self-indications, sort of things that he wrote a short story about his own first visit to a prostitute. He wrote a short story about how much he hated Corsica, the country of his... France. Because of his Corsican nationalism, and that involves a lot of really deep, dark, sort of tortuous aspects of his personality. It gets very violent and sadistic, frankly. So yeah, we're talking about a very complex character here. Just because he had a wonderful sense of humor doesn't mean he wasn't a very complicated personality.
I want to obviously ask you about this concept of Napoleon complex. That's probably the biggest preconception out there. The definition that I found online is it's an inferiority complex whereby one is overly aggressive or dominating in order to compensate for their feelings of social inferiority. Now,
well, Napoleon, I mean, there is, I'm sure there is such a thing as a Napoleon complex. It's just that Napoleon didn't have one. He had no feelings of inferiority. All this business about him being short is complete rubbish.
Which I'm upset about, because he's actually, I'm 5'3", and I was disappointed to find out he was 5'5".
Yeah, and 5'5" was the average height of a Frenchman in the 18th century. So, you know, the reason people think that he was so small is that he is that the British caricaturists constantly made him look small, you know, as a way of denigrating him. And he simply wasn't. He was a normal size. He also didn't have this hubristic, there's an aspect of the Napoleon complex where you're, as you mentioned, are over aggressive. And this is, everyone says, well, you can see this in the invasion of Russia in 1812. But the fact was that he'd beaten the Russians twice before in earlier campaigns. He had an army over twice the size of the Russian army. He had no intention of spending more than 3 weeks in Russia and going about 50 miles inside Russia. He didn't plan to go to Moscow. And he was sucked in. It was a brilliant Russian generalship that brought him further and further into Russia. But even when he got to Moscow and planned the retreat from Moscow, he left himself more time to get back to Smolensk than he'd taken getting from Smolensk to Moscow. So this was not this kind of... He'd invaded Russia with the largest force ever seen in history before. It was about 615,000 men, which was the same size as the entire population of Paris, which was easily the biggest European city at that time. So, you know, this was not a lunatic act of hubris which he was bound to lose. This was instead an attempt to punish the Russians for continuing to trade with, for starting to trade with the British after the Treaty of Tilsit. And one that seemed, on the face of it, when he crossed the river Niemen on the 21st of June 1812, to be a sort of perfectly understandable sort of punishment beating of the Russians. What he obviously, nobody could possibly know, was that 100,000 troops of his central striking force were going to go down to typhus, this horrible disease where you get a louse in your bloodstream and sends you mad and kills you after 4 days. And this happened to his to a huge proportion of his army. He then chose the wrong way back. And after the Battle of Mali and Aroslavets in on the 25th of October 1812, he took the wrong route back out of, and that was the thing that ultimately was disastrous for him because of the blizzards that hit. So, you know, that was one decision out of thousands of decisions that he took.
But when you think of the Napoleon complex, which you're saying Napoleon oddly did not have, you think about this person who is insecure and who is power hungry and on a bit of a power trip in order to compensate for those insecurities. But it sounds like that's not really what
it was. It's all total rot. That is all complete rubbish, yeah.
So, Andrew, Napoleon's place in history to end off, what, I mean, there's so many elements of his lasting legacy, but he aspired to be as great, as we said, as Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great. How does he stack up compared to them? In many ways, he seems to have been a much more complete leader who outlasted them in terms of longevity and maybe ultimately was involved in more facets of society in addition to the military.
Yes, that's a really good question. I mean, in, just in terms of as a conqueror, of course, Alexander the Great conquered the whole known world, virtually. So you can't really do better than going from India to Egypt and Macedonia down to virtually the whole way around the Mediterranean. It was that was extraordinary. However, he didn't really reform all the places that he went to. He went there and set up satrapies and allies, but then he left. Napoleon, on the other hand, we'll come on to Julius Caesar in a second. Napoleon, on the other hand, very much wanted, not in Russia, but in most of the other places, to set up a kind of society which was different from the ancien regime ones that he was replacing. And that isn't true of Russia, which still had serfdom and which he didn't do anything significantly to abolish. With regard to Julius Caesar, who was his ultimate role model, Caesar, of course, did do a lot of reforms and had planned many more before his assassination. And so rightly, and in fact, it's a little known fact that Napoleon actually wrote a biography of Julius Caesar, which has recently been published in English, extremely well translated, very good book, very short book. Nonetheless, it's an interesting thing that Napoleon should have spent his time in exile actually writing the biography of Julius Caesar. And I think you know, that it would be hard to deny that it does deserve to be placed in the same kind of context as Julius Caesar, who was arguably the you know, greatest leader of all time.
And your book, at the beginning, in the introduction, I mentioned this concept, Napoleon the Great, and that's up for debate. Some people might say not so great, but clearly your stance is that Napoleon is quite an amazing, great figure.
Yes, it was the name of the book in England, partly because my publisher Stuart Prophet wanted to start a debate and to irritate a lot of reviewers, which it certainly managed to do, and to cause a stir, which it also managed to do. We didn't go with that title in America, or indeed anywhere else. I don't think. Perhaps, no, in France, of course, we did, but. I think it stands up. I really do. He's an extraordinary figure, as I say, a much more approachable character than he seems. It's not all just battles and boring educational reforms. It is laughter and jokes, and you know, he had 27 mistresses. We haven't even talked about his love life, which was a completely, you know, off the charts when it comes to and his extraordinary erotic letters that he wrote to Josephine, and his rather touching and loving marriage to Mary Louise, the daughter of the Emperor of Austria. These, you know, that whole side of him as well as a lover is something you just can't believe he had found the time apart from anything else. But I suppose men are always able to find the time, aren't they?
Well, Andrew, thank you so, so much for spending this time with me. It's really, really an absolute privilege to be able to chat with somebody so acclaimed as yourself on this podcast. Is there any place you want to direct people to in order to learn more about you or any of your upcoming books?
Well, my website, www.andrew-roberts.net is the place, definitely. And my next book, actually, is a biography of King George III. I'm going to try and persuade you Americans that he wasn't the tyrant of the Declaration of Independence or the villain of Hamilton the musical, but was much more interesting, much more complicated, much more attractive figure than either of them.
Well, I will absolutely put that in the episode notes. And thanks again. And thank you to everybody for listening to this exciting episode of Preconceived. I really hope you enjoyed it and have a great day.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.